just got on my traveling shoe.
The group known as A Cappella, singing A Cappella. Actually, they were singing Traveling Shoes, the name of the song. 10 and a half minutes after the hour, it's a Wednesday morning, and we're joined by Doug Greenwald of Preserving Bible Times. He's the senior teaching fellow there and the executive director. Normally, we speak to Doug from Columbia, Maryland, just outside of Washington. But today, we find Doug in the Hoosgow someplace in Kansas. And he's going to be
I was in prison last night.
Oh, okay.
Must have been good behavior. They let me out.
Yeah, apparently so.
So I'm in Wichita, Kansas here this morning, but we're going to go back to the prison tonight to finish up our Passion of Jesus series there. And then tomorrow night, we're going to another prison. And every one of these prison experiences is unique. Some common ground for sure, but always something special about each one, both positive and negative. And it just adds to the adventure, the sense of adventure of this ministry, because when you walk into a prison, you're never quite sure what's going to be waiting for you.
I imagine the experience can be a pretty impressive. And the Wichita area has received you warmly, haven't they?
They have, and the Kansas City area as well. This is our second trip back to Wichita. We have two more. We're coming back here four times on an annual basis. And each time I'm trying to come a few days early and work some prison work into it. The last prison we were at was up in Kansas City. We went to historic Leavenworth Prison, and that was quite an experience. And by the way, for your listeners, the trip report called The Leaven of Leavenworth is up for free download on our website in the articles section, the complimentary download section. So, and as well as another one, the first one we ever did in Ellsworth, Kansas, a state prison. That trip report is up on the website in that same place for complimentary download. So if you're intrigued at all with what these visits to prisons are like and the kind of teaching experiences we encounter, they're free to read on the website.
Yeah, beautiful new website too, preservingbibletimes.org. You spell it all out, run it together like one word, preservingbibletimes.org. You'll be impressed with that website. And Doug, I've been so impressed, and we've covered this now in a couple of succeeding years, Passion Week. It is so packed, and when we, with our Western paradigms and points of view, pick up the Bible and read the gospel story of the account starting with Lazarus, and then Jesus' entrance into Jerusalem on the donkey, and the things he says and does, it's interesting. There's a little impact there. It's like, oh, this is history. But it's kind of what's between the lines that we don't normally perceive. And once, you know, you've exposed that to us, the story takes on so much more intensity and four dimensions. It's just amazing.
Well, that's why the byline, when we give these presentations on the last 40 days of Jesus, it's : the greatest story never completely told. And that's true, because we read it through Western eyes, but when we understand it through Near Eastern eyes from the perspective of first century Jewish villagers, what's John has from John 11 through the end of John just becomes deeper and wider and richer.
Very powerful week, and it should be for us too, and knowing that historic and cultural context helps make it so. Where are we today? Where do we pick up the story today?
Well, since we did Palm Sunday last Wednesday, I thought let's go a couple days forward in what's known as the teaching days, and I just want to pull out one parable from that teaching day period, because I think it's one that we miss in terms of its weight and its import, and it's found in Luke 19. It's known as the parable of money usage. That's really a weak header, and that brings up this whole issue again: who's creating these headers to break up the text?
Distraction sometimes, really.
Well, and it puts the emphasis on the wrong syllable too.
Yes, get your point.
It tends to point us not necessarily in totally the right direction. But listen to this one. This is different than the parable of the talents, although we tend to think it's the same thing. Jesus starts out in 19:11. While they were listening to these things, and this is right after the Zacchaeus experience, While they were listening to these things, Jesus went on to tell a parable because he was near Jerusalem, and they supposed that the kingdom of God was going to appear immediately. And Luke is telling us here that the crowds are convinced Jesus is Messiah. Because they're Jewish, they know what the rabbis have taught, and that is this: when Messiah comes, he will go straight to the temple, set up his throne, and reign, and there will be peace, prosperity, and social justice, finally, in this promised land. Okay? That's their expectation. So Jesus has to deal with this expectation, and immediately he starts to shift it into a different direction. Verse 12 here. So Jesus said, "A nobleman went to a distant country to receive a kingdom for himself and then return." Now, we really are missing the context of what Jesus just said and the historical backdrop that goes with it. And it is this: when Rome conquers your part of the world, whether it's Syria or Palestine or whatever, their governing strategy generally is not to put in their own procreator. Their first line of defense of subjugation is to have a puppet king, okay? And this is well known. And so whenever Rome comes in and conquers your part of the world, there are noblemen, well-placed political people, if you will, who think, ah, this is my chance to be a puppet king. So I'm going to go to Rome with a little bit of my entourage here, and I'm going to go to the Roman Senate, and I'm going to plead my case as to why I should become the puppet king. But you also need to understand that there are several other aspirants to be puppet king, and they're doing exactly the same thing. Okay? So as soon as Rome conquers an area, there are several parties, several small entourages, who head to Rome to plead their case to see if Rome will allow them to come back and be king of this little territory, this area. And the backdrop here is that in 40 BC, Herod the Great went to Rome and was successful in convincing the Roman Senate to allow him to be king of the Jews, and he comes back and is king. Now, there were other groups that also went to Rome in 40 BC, and they lost. And you don't ever want to be part of a known entourage who supported the loser, mm-hmm. because you're probably going to get killed, mm-hmm. okay? I mean, there's no mercy in this kind of a culture. Your competitor is your enemy. Well, there's another piece of backdrop here. When Herod the Great dies in 4 BC, his son, Archelaus, goes to Rome as well, goes through the same deal. Let me carry on and be king for my father. They said, okay, let's give it a try. And after about 4 years, they were so upset with the way he tried to govern that they removed him from the post. So the backdrop here is people go to Rome, sometimes they win and sometimes they lose, and it's a competitive situation, and you don't ever want to be known in the public arena as supporting the loser, because when the winner comes back, they're taking names and this is going to have consequences. All right,
they will eliminate their rivals. Yeah,
that's the backdrop to verse 12. So then Jesus, in verse 13, he calls 10 of his slaves and gave them 10 minas, a measure of money, and said to them, now listen to this, do business with this, okay, until I come back. That's the instruction. Do business with this. Verse 14, but his citizens hated him and sent a delegation after him saying, we do not want this man to reign over us. That raises the stakes that maybe your man won't win, okay? Mm-hmm. If people are so upset with him that there's another delegation who follows you to Rome and said, hey, whatever he just told you was not true, don't put your trust in him. It just raises the stakes that you got to be very careful if you're supporting this nobleman who's going there, because there are people coming behind him that will say, we don't want him to reign over us. Verse 15, when he returned after receiving the kingdom, so he was successful mm-hmm. in receiving the kingdom, he ordered that these slaves to whom he had given the money be called to him so that he might know what business they had done. Okay, It's a very interesting phrase, what business they had done. Notice it doesn't say what return on investment they had earned. Mm-hmm. That's the point I want to drive to here.
Yeah.
We Westerners think ROI, return on investment, okay? And Jesus is saying something different here. I want you to represent me in the marketplace. I want you to stand for me. I want you to be identified with me. I want you to tell my story, okay? That's a different issue than I'm making you responsible for the return on investment. Then the first one appeared and said, Master, your mina has made 10 minas more. Well done, good slave, because you have been faithful in a very little thing. You are to be authority over 10 cities. And it continues on from there. Here's the point I want to make. When you stand for Jesus in the marketplace, which he commands you to do, don't worry about the return on investment. What Jesus is simply asking you to do is to be faithful, to stand for him, to be identified with him, to talk about him in the marketplace. The return on investment is his domain. He's the one that ripens the fields to harvest. Hmm. And so what Jesus is saying here, because he's shortly to leave in the resurrection and return to heaven, is I want you to stand for me, to transact for me in the marketplace, to represent me, to be identified with me, and don't get hung up on the return on investment. Don't be shy. Don't be scared, because the return on investment is my domain, not your domain.
Now, he's talking to his disciples here, is he not?
Yes, he is.
Okay, so he's not talking to the crowd in general. And I think that's an important distinction too. That this is instruction for them.
These are his representatives. Mm-hmm.
And at what point in Passion Week you said this, that he had just dealt with Zacchaeus, and he was still en route to Jerusalem then?
And the way Luke constructs the narrative, mm-hmm. yeah, this is between Zacchaeus and Palm Sunday.
Okay, gotcha. Okay.
So observation number one, and I think there's great comfort there. Is if people reject us, don't take it personally.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be held against you. Mm-hmm. If you do what you feel is a spirit-inspired job of representing Jesus in the marketplace and there doesn't seem to be immediate response, relax. It's not your responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Your requirement is to stand for him, to represent him, to be identified with him, to talk about him. And the domain of the return on investment is the kingdom of God itself and the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, that is comforting because we, I think, as disciple makers, as we fancy ourselves, if we haven't returned more people to him than we started with, we failed. And you're saying that's not the case.
Exactly. And how many missionary reports haven't we heard in churches where, you know, we basically get the report of how many notches on the gun?
Yeah. Body counts,
yeah.
In essence, yeah. That is comforting.
Okay, let's switch over to the upper room discourse. We're just going to do some vignette hopping here this morning. I want to go to John 14 and look at verses 2 and 3.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is the upper room discourse. This is where, let's say, the first communion takes place. And in chapter 14... before we get to chapter 15, and Jesus is talking about the vine and abiding in me, he starts out in chapter 14, do not let your heart be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many dwelling places. Some translations say are many rooms. Some translations for house have mansion. In my Father's mansion are many rooms. In my Father's house are many dwelling places. If it were not so, I would have told you. For I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. Now, verses 2 and 3. My Father's house are many dwelling places. I go and prepare a place for you. I will return again and come for you. This is wedding talk.
That's what I was just going to say. This is wedding stuff. It is.
Absolutely, this is wedding stuff. And the backdrop here is a form of housing which some of the more wealthy people have in this very, very poor culture, called Insula homes, I-N-S-U-L-A-E. It means multi-room homes, multi-room housing. And I'm going to have to use your mind as a blackboard on this one because I can't flash a picture.
Well, that's blank. It's blank for you. I'm ready.
It's blank. It's good. Then we won't need an eraser.
No.
Is that I would take you to a place called Chorazin, which is about 2 miles as the crow flies from Capernaum up in the northwest quadrant of the Sea of Galilee. And I'd go up in a helicopter and I'd look down on the remains of Chorazin and we would see the remains of an insula home. To try to describe it here, it would be a large square that might be 120 feet on a side. Okay. And in the very beginning, the family puts up walls around all four sides here and leaves a door and builds one room in one corner of this now very large enclosed square. That's for mom and dad. Then let's say they give birth to 5 boys over time. And the 5 boys grow up. And eventually they all, a bride is negotiated for them by dad. And a betrothal contract is entered into. And there's a little ceremony that goes takes place there. And they're actually legally married in the eyes of this culture, although they can't consummate their marriage. And so the bride stays at her family's home, and the son goes back to mom and dad's place, and he starts to build now a second room in this big enclosed square next to mom and dad's. It's going to probably be about 15 foot deep, and it's probably going to be no more than about 6 foot wide. And there's some construction reasons for that, okay? And when he has completed his room, then he tells one of his friends, go tell the bride that I'm going to be coming shortly, because he wants her to be ready. And then he goes and calls her. There's a whole ceremony protocol for this. And then there's a multi-day wedding feast. And then he takes her to his place, his single room in the family compound where they consummate their marriage. This happens for sons 2, 3, 4, and 5. All right. So for the first generation here, we started with one room in the corner, and now we've got 6 rooms. And we're probably halfway up one side of the wall of this quadrant here, this big square. And then they're going to have children, and the boys are going to do the same thing, and you get the idea here. After a while, there are going to be 30, 40 rooms up one side, down the other, perhaps halfway down the third side now, until this thing is eventually filled in. And there are actually archaeological remains of insula homes in Israel that appears that 150 people have lived in.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Like an apartment complex.
So that's the backdrop here to this statement.
One quick question.
If it were not so, I would have told you. And I'm going to prepare a place for you because you're my bride. And when I've prepared the room, I'm going to come for you. And I'm going to take you to myself.
Now, I don't want to throw you off track here, but one question, because it raced across my mind. You said at this point, the groom would send his friend to alert the bride. I'm thinking John the Baptist. That symbolism.
How about the Holy Spirit?
That too. Yeah. It all works. It's just the patterns in all this are so marvelous. I mean, it's allegory and it's history all at the same time.
Now, here's the fusion I want to make. Generally, when we approach the Eucharist, communion, we're thinking Jesus dying on the cross, shedding his blood. It's a very somber and sober sort of motif that's created. Silence, okay? Meditation, pondering. I would suggest we need to do two things. We need to remember that, the soberness and the somberness of his crucifixion. We also need to evoke the joy and the celebration of this wedding motif. And we need to fuse those two thoughts together because both thoughts are given here in the upper room. The last words of Jesus. And so I like to encourage people as you approach the communion table to have a somber sense of celebration.
I'll work on that. I'll massage that a little bit, see if I can if I can
see,
synthesize.
It's hard for the Western mind because we're either or. It's either this or either that. In the Jewish mind, it's about taking disparate things, paradoxical things, and fusing them together. And so we have to become Jewish in our worldview to understand and embrace this notion of a somber celebration.
Okay, back to John 14. So he's preparing a room in his father's mansion or his father's house. And you've explained the insula homes and how that process works. How does this relate to the Minos now? Not the Minos. Not to the Minos, but to the rest of 14 here.
Continue on with your question.
Okay, at this point, Jesus is in the upper room when he presents this?
Oh, very much so. Okay. In the Essene quarter, we feel fairly confident.
Okay.
In a monastery, the Essene monastery. In what's known as the Cataluma, the guest room.
What makes you think it was in the Essene quarter?
Well, remember that little detail that we're given in John? As Jesus starts to make preparations for that, he sends two of his disciples off and he says, look for a man carrying a water jar. Men never carry water jars
in
this culture. Unless they're only men in the community. That's the Essene community.
My goodness. And the Essene Quarter was a section of Jerusalem. It was a ghetto, a neighborhood. It was where the Essenes hung out. They were known for hospitality, weren't they?
They were, and they were also known for their ascetic nature. And just to go way back in history, they had their own community down in Qumran. It's where the Dead Sea Scrolls came from and what have you. But there was a significant earthquake in about 25 BC, I'm not quite precise on the dates there, which destroyed basically the Essene community. And because one of the Essene elders had made a very pleasant and optimistic prophecy for Herod the Great that he would have a long reign, Herod was predisposed towards the Essenes and granted them a portion of Jerusalem to now recreate their community that had gotten destroyed by an earthquake. And that's where the Essene community came to be in Jerusalem. And if you go to Israel, to the Israel Museum, right at the entrance there, there's a big outdoor recreation model of Jerusalem in the first century, you can actually see the Essene Quarter. I've actually stood there and walked around this thing. It's about half the size of a football field. It's a very big model of Jerusalem. And I take them to the portion where the Essene community was, and there's actually an Essene monastery that's recreated there. And in my way of thinking, that's the site of the upper room experience, both the farewell discourse. And then you can see the journey that Jesus had to take with the disciples from the monastery in the Essene Quarter over towards Temple Mount, down through the Kidron Valley to get the Gethsemane. It's a real nice model to get these pictures in your mind.
Now, more on the Essenes. I'm hungry for this now. The Essenes were another sect of another religious segment that came into being back in the Hasmonean period, weren't they? They were kind of counterposition to the Pharisees and the Sadducees. It was a third division of Jewish thought, and as I understand their history, they were opposed, especially to the Sadducees. They were kind of counterculture.
Well, they saw and knew, like most people did, the utter corruption of the Sadducees running the temple. The total compromises that some of the Jerusalem Pharisees has made in the Sanhedrin, and how they were all in cahoots to extort the people, running 9 businesses out of Temple Incorporated, the biggest cash cow machine of its day. And so their method of objecting was to withdraw.
So they withdrew to their quarter.
And we are nothing, no part of this corrupt scene. We're going to create our own purity scene out in the Judean. We're not going to have to deal with this kind of corrupt environment. And that's the backdrop sect, if you will, and they developed a whole protocol to be a disciple in the Essene community. It was a 2-year probationary period. You had to prove your worth. You had to earn the right to become a full-fledged disciple. They had very elaborate ritual purification protocols. They had a big scriptorium, obviously, where they created all these scrolls that became discovered as the Dead Sea Scroll. They're really an interesting group. And for many, I don't say many, but there's a good group of people, historians, who feel that because John the Baptist was born so late in life with Zechariah and Elizabeth, that they probably died before John even became a teenager. And it was the Essene community who raised John the Baptist.
You know,
that would help explain his ascetic nature and why he was very much comfortable in the wilderness. Because his Essene experience, if you go with this line of traditional thinking here, would have very much oriented him that way.
You know, it just astounds me how the pieces are starting to come together, because I've been doing some reading on this for another project I'm involved in. The Essenes, I am informed, actually had a Nazarene community of Essenes. There was a Nazarene kind of department of the Essenes up there. And I'm wondering, because in their tradition, they revere something called the Teacher of Righteousness is the central figure. Supposedly, it was a Jewish high priest who founded them back under the Hasmoneans in the mid to second century B.C. And now here we are in the first century, and it would be very easy to associate Jesus with that, because also when Jesus sends his disciples out, he tells them to find the man who's carrying water and say to him, basically, the teacher is looking for, or he said the teacher. I've never seen himself call himself the teacher anywhere else in Scripture. But if he was talking to an Essene, I'm wondering if Jesus already had a cozy relationship with the Essenes. Certainly he knew of them and they knew of him.
Well, when you get into the Essene writings, you discover the imagery they use is they refer to the light and darkness a lot. And Jesus said, I am the light of the world. So, you know, you can certainly...
Yeah, we're starting to break up here with the audio a little bit. We'll wait for Doug. He'll pop back, I'm sure. Are you there, Doug?
I'm still here.
Yeah, we're having, it's not problems with either of us. It's in between someplace. A little bit of Skype nonsense going
on.
Well,
I'm in Kansas, so that's a lot of crows on the line between here and central Minnesota.
It could be. It could well be. Well, so he's in the upper room now, and it's in the Essene quarter of Jerusalem. There's a lot of tradition involved in a Passover Seder supper, but this was a very different kind of Seder supper, wasn't it?
Well, there's a lot of technical discussion about what kind of Seder was this, or was it even a Seder?
And when was it, for that matter?
Well, see, we got two calendars at work here. The Essene community functions off the solar calendar, and the Jewish community functions off the lunar calendar, and they are different. So one of the interesting observations here, and I don't have enough time to develop the thought, is that Jesus is doing Passover on the Essene calendar, and he becomes the Paschal Lamb on the Jewish calendar.
And that would put the Last Supper, because there were several days difference between the two by this time.
Yes.
It would have been probably what we would call Tuesday evening, or it would be the beginning of when 6 p.m. was the time that the Jewish day started. So if they had their Seder Supper, what we would call Tuesday evening through the early hours of Wednesday morning, that could have been the Passover for the Essene community.
And there's lots of technical debate under, was this a 3-cup or a 4-cup?
That's right. Four was traditional.
Passover meal
very,
was
very
it truly a Seder meal. Children present to represent the disciples. Some argue that this is just a special banquet, not a true Seder, not a true Passover. So there's lots of technical discussions, and I don't think that's very additive. It doesn't change any of our collective understandings of what happened there. But let me make, in our time available here, one more observation. I'm going to go to John 18, and we're going to deal with Peter here. And let me read verses 25 and 27 in John 18. This is known as Peter's denial of Jesus. Now Simon Peter was standing and warming himself in the courtyard at Caiaphas's place, And so they, those who were also in the courtyard, said to him, "You are not also one of his disciples, are you?" And Peter denied it and said, "I am not." And one of the slaves of the high priest, being a relative of the one whose ear Peter cut off, that was in Gethsemane, just a little bit before, said, "Did I not see you in the garden with him?" Peter then denied it again, and immediately a rooster crowed. Now, freeze that thought. Because I want to talk about something called cockcrow. C-R-O-C-K-O-W. Cockcrow. Mm-hmm. One word. That is the name given to the sound emitted by the shofar horn, the ram's horn, that's blown at the southwest corner of the temple.
That's the Hebrew word for it.
It is, cockcrow. Mm-hmm. You can see where we're heading here, right?
Yeah.
As the English people, missing the context of what the sound of the shofar horn was called for, when it started going in a different direction. Well, the shofar horn is blown first thing in the morning when the morning lamb is sacrificed and the temple gates are open for worship. The first shofar sound is made, okay? So Peter has denied Jesus three times and the cockcrow is heard, and he's reminded of what Jesus said he would do. He was reminded of his own denials three times, and he is now ritually unclean because he has lied. Therefore, he is prohibited prohibited at this moment in time from going to temple to worship because he is unclean. And it's the sound of the cockcrow sound from the shofar horn that brings him that awareness, that understanding. And so when cockcrow has been separated into two words, cockcrow, and then that has been further redefined as rooster crows, you see how we lose some of the weight and significance here?
Boy, do I. Yes.
Because it's the worship experience. It's his ritual uncleanness. It's the fact that worship can now commence upon hearing the sounds of the cockcrow, that Peter is just giving this devastating awareness that I have not only blown it, I am unclean. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole lot different than just hearing a rooster crow.
And again, that's the Jewish context. We have to understand that the audience for this was Jews. They would have sensed the intensity of all that, wouldn't they?
And we have to go back to our fundamental understanding here is that John, and he writing his scroll, assumed that those who would read his scroll lived when, where, and how he did. And therefore, John has no need to explain what everyone knew to be true. It's just that 2,000 years later, removing ourselves from the Jewish first century agrarian world, Near Eastern world of the Bible, into our 21st century urban
Yeah, we've lost audio temporarily again here. I think Doug will bounce back yet. Oh, I think maybe check your button down there too. He's hearing me, and we're not hearing him. So
I happened to hit the on-off button and the pause button.
There you
Sorry,
go.
Where did we end up?
Well, we were talking about cockcrow, and my mind was fixed. There was no rooster. There was no rooster.
Yeah, and that's what happens when The context of the first century, village agrarian, Jewish, is left behind. And we bring our own context from the 21st century, Greek thinking, postmodern, urban, industrialized way of thinking. A lot gets lost. And that's why we do contextual restoration. The things that John assumed his audience would always know and understand, a lot of it's missing in action. We have to put it back in place. And when we do, these passages get deeper and wider and richer.
It's just amazing. Doug, this is so important to us. Will you do it again next week?
Absolutely. I'll be in Dallas, Texas next week. But
on the road.
Let's deal with the last days. And for sure, let's meet this chap called Barabbas.
And there was no rooster. Just astounding. Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. On the road from Kansas today, from Dallas next time. And in a couple of weeks, be back home in Maryland. Doug, we'll look forward to you. Travel safely. Have a great day. I know it's going to be a lot of work and a real experience for you.
Thanks, Jim, and say hi to David for me.
We'll do it. Bye-bye. Music continues at a Broken Road Radio Wednesday.